Hello. Thank you very much, and welcome to the Riverside for this very special evening. I'm Catherine Lana, and it's been my pleasure to organise this evening on behalf of Browser's Bookshop, your local independent bookshop, and the Riverside Theatre. And we're very pleased to have Alan Johnson here with us tonight. He's going to be talking to us about his latest book, which I'm going to move that and just display, just in case you haven't got your copy in your hand. So we're going to be talking about this book for about 40 to 45 minutes, and then there'll be the opportunity for your questions, and then we'll have further opportunity for you to come and talk to Alan and get your book signed. And it's a good Christmas present if you haven't thought about that already, so there will be the opportunity to buy more copies, but we'll talk about that later. So, In My Life, a music memoir. So this is your fourth memoir. Yeah. Should we just go back to the beginning and find out how they all came about? What the first book, This Boy, can you tell us a little bit how you came to write that in the first place?
Well, I feel very privileged because many writers, would-be writers, you know, have to get themselves a publisher and an agent and all of that. But when I, when the electorate decided to dispense with our services in 2010, there was a lot of interest in an Alan Johnson book, so I had publishers who were coming with all kinds of suggestions. I got myself an agent, a great guy called Andrew Kidd, who's since moved on, but he said to me, look, you know, do you really want to do the box standard political memoir, you know, revisiting arguments that everyone's forgotten about that happened 20 years ago? You know, I don't read them. I find them very boring. He said, why don't you tell the story of your childhood, which I'd not really told when I was a politician, because it felt like you were trying to take advantage of your, you know, especially in the Labour Party, you can sometimes be aristocracy, the poorer you were. So that old Monty Python thing, you know, there was 120 of us in a rolled-up newspaper, literally, 250 of us in a shoebox. But, you know, what really excited me was the chance to make my mother live again on the page. So she died very young, when I was very young. Nobody knew she'd passed through this world. You know, there's not even a gravestone or anywhere marking her. And if I could I make her live again on the page? Not just the circumstances of what we lived in, as many people did, the kind of poverty, post-war poverty, the slums. But also, you know, bring her to life. You know, she was a funny, pretty, petite scouse. And of course, my incredible sister. So they were the two heroes of the book. And it was a labour of love. But also, I think I was trying to describe a part of West London that disappeared. Everyone talked about this swathe of West London as being Notting Hill. We didn't see Julia Grant or Hugh Roberts around our way very much. I mean, we lived in London West End, which was North Kensington. And unfortunately and tragically, since the book was published in 2013, people know about North Kensington because of Grenfell Tower. Mm. And about the horrific statistic now, today, a boy born in North Kensington, as I was, will on average die 16 years earlier than a boy born in South Kensington. One London borough, the Royal Borough of Kensington. And that has always been, cheek by jowl, great prosperity and utter poverty. And so I wanted to try and describe that as well.
And you did it brilliantly, of course. I mean, it won prizes, and it's been hugely well received. So how did you feel about that? What were you expecting?
I only wanted to write that one bit of a memoir, because I'm very keen to write fiction, to which a cynic would say, why not write your next party manifesto? That would be the cynical view of politics. But it did so well, and won not just the Orwell Prize, which I was puzzled about, I was very pleased, but it's for political writing. Yeah. It wasn't an ostensibly political book. We won the Ondaatje Prize, which is about evocation, so I was very pleased with that. And, of course, many people said, it ends when I'm 18, you know, what happened next? So then came Please, Mr. Postman, and then I had to finish the job with The Long and Winding Road.
Right, well, let's go through those as well. Because, I mean, you left school at 15, I think, wasn't it? And and that's when you did want to explore your musical bent, if you like, the become a rock star, but it never happened.
I'm still hoping to become a rock star.
There's still time. Isn't
the past tense,
yes.
Sorry. But that's part of the joy of writing this book, you know, as I see there's a few baby boomers in the audience here. We were there at the birth of all of this, or not the birth, then the kind of postnatal phase, you know. If you say the birth of rock and roll was Bill Haley and the Comets and Elvis in America, and Skiffle and Lonnie Donegan over here, you know, it happened, we grew up with it. And so it was really exciting. Me and my sister were mad about music, as anyone who's read this story will know. But you couldn't access music. This is the thing, it was famine. Now we've gone to feast. You know, you can access music everywhere now.
Yeah.
But for us baby boomers, the music we wanted to hear, you know, so when I was a kid, our radio rentals, wireless, was sort of, an engineer came and put it in, so you couldn't tune it into whatever station you liked. There was a Bakelite switch with three numbers on it, and switch one was the light program, two was the home service, three was the third program, classical music, so you had your own station if you wanted classical music. And if you wanted to listen to pop music, it very rarely came on the light program, because the BBC had a deal with the Musicians Union that they would only play 16 hours of recorded music a week, all the rest had to be live. So it was really difficult, and audience members here will remember, if you could. So my mum bought me a crystal radio set when I was about 9, and you clipped it onto a piece of metal and you tried it. And if you eventually got Radio Luxembourg, you got this bloke who had a foolproof way of winning the pools. Horace Thatcher. And I always thought, 9 years of age, when he's got a foolproof way of winning the pools, why is he winning the pools? But he would have this infra-draw method, and you'd have to listen to this first of all, and he would say, if you want to know how to win the pools, send away for this infra-draw method. And I always remember this. You write to Horace Batchelor at Keynsham, K-E-Y-N-S-H-A-M, Keynsham, Bristol. So when you got through this, you still went here a bit of pop music. You then got this fearsome American evangelist, Garner Ted Armstrong. This is Garner Ted Armstrong with the world tomorrow. And you know, you'd listen to this, you'd say, and the radio would shake. Some people tell me there's no God, I tell you there is a God. And once you've gone through all that, you might get a bit of pop music from about 8 o'clock onwards, if you could hear it from the static. So we had all that. It was difficult to listen to pop music. And we launched this book at Studio 2 Abbey Road, which is where the Beatles did all their great hits. And when we were there in September, I was reminded that Mandy Miller recorded Nellie the Elephant in that studio. The producer was George Martin. And of course, the thing about Mandy Miller is she predicted the coming of the 45th President of the United States. If you remember, Nellie the Elephant packed her trunk, said goodbye to the circus, off she went with a trumpety trunk, but that was like British pop music in the 50s, you know. I mean, who remembers Pinky and Perky? Two puppets. I mean, talk about you can see the strings. There was no skin involved in the puppetry. They had top 10 hits. And you know, one of the delights of being a teenager in those days is when we eventually got a dance set, my mum had a little win on the pools in 1957 and bought Linda, my sister, a dance set record player, and me a guitar, a kind of basic acoustic guitar for my older catalogue. But when you put Pinky and Perky records on, you had three settings of speed. You had 33 and a third for LPs, 45 for singles, and 78 for the old shellac old records. And if you played Pinky and Perky at 33 and a third, you could hear the non-Pinky voices because it slowed it down. That passed as entertaining. That's how we spent our evening in the 50s.
Right. Well, the way that you're reeling off these memories, obviously, it's close to your heart and close to recall. So was it as easy to write the book then? Was this book easier than the other three books to write?
Easier?
Quicker?
I mean, yeah, a bit quicker because, you know, what I've done, so 25 years, from 1957, which is my first memory of a piece of music, and that was a Sunday lunchtime when everybody listened. Baby boomers will remember this. Everybody listened to Two Way Family favourites on the radio. You can almost smell the roasting lamb. And, you know, they had that, the record that this was for servicemen serving abroad from their families and vice versa, Two Way Family favourites. And the record that had the most requests was called the Bumper Bundle. And I remember this particular Sunday in 1957, the Bumper Bundle was True Love by Bing Crosby and Grace Kelly. And I remember my mother was cooking the lunch. All the men went off to the pub in North Kensington. My father was hardly out of the pub. He was a pub pianist for a start. But they all wore their suits. They all put their suits on, many cases, but the demon suit, you know, collar and tie, to go to the pub on a Sunday lunchtime. And indeed, I remember that still on the council estate where I lived in the 70s. I'm just going, please, Mr. Postman, the older generation would get suited up to go for a Sunday. Anyway, the women, like my mother, who had a, you know, had a hard life, she didn't know whether he was going to come back. He didn't come back once, and then in the end, left it when, in 1958 when I was eight. But she would, her release from this was to when True Love came on, we had a gas cooker out on the landing. She would come in, sit down in whatever old chair was there, the dishcloth across her knees, and just be transported by this music. She used to go to the pictures once a week, all on her own, and used to, you know, take, she wore a turban and an overall most of the time, and off would come the overall, off would come the turban, so a very pretty chestnut hair, which she'd pin and grip to go to the pictures, and put lipstick on and perfume, as if the kind of glamour on the screen had to be replicated in the audience. And so, you know, that was one thing about how music is a release for people, but also how it pins a memory down. You know, there's nothing so evocative as a piece of music. You're back there. So in that sense, it was easier to write, because all through the 25 years up till 1982, when I finally concluded I wasn't going to be a big rock and roll star and should go off and do something else, is 25 pieces of music is a chapter heading. And once the music is there, the kind of memories flow from that. Including the memory, and I don't know how many people here remember this, it just struck me as I was reading it. So when I was born in Southam Street, they were terrible conditions, slum conditions. We had no electricity, so the first five, 6 years of my life was lived by gaslight. By the time my mum got had this Paul's win, we got the Dan set in 1957, we had electric lights and we had electric street lights. But there were no plugs in the skirting board. Why would there be plugs in the skirting board? Nobody had fridges, nobody had a telly, nobody had a Hoover, nobody had a washing machines. So how did you plug the bloody thing in? Well, you get an adapter. My sister, 9 years of age, would stand on a chair, I would hold her ankles while she took the folder off. Do you remember this? Then you had an adapter that plugged the Dan set in through the, which means you could only listen to music during daylight hours. But people said, you know, remember their mum do the ironing with it plugged into the days before electricity was ubiquitous. So those memories come back, and that's, you know, that's a great trigger for a memoirist.
And the first book has, this boy has got fantastic descriptions of that early life. I mean, it was a hard time, but you describe it beautifully and with warmth, nevertheless. And then we go on to your early life as a postman, so an early family life. And then that wasn't without its own struggles as well. But music was always the priority, even then. So I think there was a time when you had to take time off work to do some DIY in the house and... but the priorities for you were saving up for money for LPs, so not buying a fridge for your wife, but buying the LPs. Can you tell us a little bit about how you prioritised in that way?
Yeah, I didn't have a hard life. I mean, the people who had the hard life were these two incredible women, my mother and my sister, I mean, my mother in particular. No, for me and my sister, we were the post-war generation. We had all the advantages of the Butler Education Act and the National Health Service. And, you know, so you know, my mum lived her whole life dreaming of a council house, walking through her own front door instead of sharing a house with, yeah, you know, two families on every floor. And she died when she was 42 and never saw that. Got the offer of a council house 2 weeks after she died. But for me, when I got married at 18, we were on the council list for a year in just off Ladbroke Grove in North Kensington. And because they were pulling the houses down to make way for the A40 extension, the Westway into London, they had to offer us a council house. And, you know, we got one offer, take it or leave it. And it was in this wonderful house, you know, three bedrooms, front garden, back garden, with two children by then, in Slough, on a big council estate called the Britwood Estate. I was incredibly fortunate. 19 years of age, I had what my mum had always dreamed of. And, you know, I had a job that, as long as you could get up at, you know, 4 o'clock in the morning, you had a pension at the end of it as a postman. And I had a union to defend my interests. Now, in many ways, those three things have diluted, you know, the house, the union to look after your interests, the pension at the end of it, the solidity, security of a job. So, no, I didn't have it hard at all. But yes, my passion with music, I think probably the starkest is when my son was born. So he was my eldest son, who was born when I was 20. So I had three kids by the time I was 20. But it was a time, 1971, just early 71, when the NHS was encouraging women to have children at home. And so my wife was upstairs with the midwife and her assistant. And this midwife was very, very experienced and very talented. And she was Irish, this lovely soft Irish brogue. She didn't want me anywhere near the birth. So I observed going from when men weren't allowed to go anywhere near childbirth to now when it's compulsory that you're going to have to be there. It's a huge change. Anyway, so it was in the house upstairs. She made it clear she didn't want me there. I'd take up the odd cup of tea. And my son was born, Jamie, with the cord around his neck. And she did a wonderful job. You know, I mean, he would have died if she wasn't so skilled. But anyway, as I had nothing to do, I took the guitar down off the wall at 2 o'clock in the morning and wrote a song for my son, Your First Day. Welcome to your first day, my son. Now your journey really has begun. I really hope you like it on the train. You'll never see that waiting room again. Anyway, yes, the midwife had heard it. And when I went up with the next cup of tea, she said, excuse the Irish accent, perhaps you have better things to do with your time, Mr. Johnson, than plonking away on that old banjo downstairs. And as I say in the book, some people have no sense of priority.
But it was a priority for you, and it wasn't just listening to the music. You wanted to play, you wanted to perform as well. And you were successful in that to an extent. You had, yes. You were in three bands, wasn't it?
Yes. Well, the first one was called The Vampires, which... So in a way, my mother was involved in all of this. So she won the Paws and got me my first guitar. I was mad about Lonnie Donegan. And my mum somehow managed to get me to the Chiswick Empire, just me, not my sister, to see Lonnie Donegan. With Joan Rooney was top of the bill. Lonnie Donegan was second. So I idolised Lonnie Donegan. And I think Skiffle got lots of, just like punk rock did, got lots of kids picking up guitars and trying to play instruments. And that's how it worked with me. But with the guitar came a book called Burt Weedon's Playing the Dirt. And it should be prosecuted under the trade description. Playing a decade, maybe. So I just sat in, you know, around squalid surroundings, I was learning, teaching myself to play the guitar. And then, so my mum got me that guitar. After she died, I was doing this, so after the story was told in This Boy, about how my sister, you know, kept us together. She was 16 and I was 30. We'd run out of parents. My sister said to me, just keep your mouth shut. Don't say anything at school or anything. Otherwise, the authorities will come and split us apart. And then that offer came up, a council house, 2 weeks after my mum died, a council house in Welling Garden City. My sister marched round to the council, said, my mum's dead, but me and my brother have had this. And this councillor said, don't be silly, the age of majority is 21. You know, you're two bits of kids. I'll send someone round. And into our life came this Mr. Pepper, our social worker. But he didn't start off well. Mr. Pepper had done his, made a little presentation to us. And in Warmer Road, just about where Grenfell Tower is now. And said, okay, Alan, you're going to live with foster parents. Linda, who'd left school at 15 to train to be a nursery nurse, you can go to Dr. Bernardo's in Barking, and you can live there and work there, complete your training. Sat back waiting for a round of applause. Instead of that, my sister tore into it, my hand on hip, wagging a finger. You're not going to separate us. And he said, well, you can't live on your own. She said, we've been living on our own for years, as we had, because my mum was in and out of hospital with this heart condition, mitral stenosis. So Linda had virtually raised me anyway. And dear old Mr. Pepper, he went away, he came back and said, okay, I've done a deal. You can have this flat. I'll get back to the retirement in a minute. You can have this flat and, you know, certain conditions, one of which is I'm going to come down every 5 minutes and keep an eye on it. Linda went off to see this flat. I didn't see it. She told me, I mean, the council thought two bits of kids were giving the worst place on our books that we can't get rid of to anyone else. Linda went and looked at it. She told me they'd taken the doors off to burn as firewood. You know, we've been in some pretty awful places. Anyway, she marched to the telephone box, put her fourpence in, dialed Mr. Pepper, pressed button A. And he said, oh, are you okay, Linda? Everything okay? She said, no, we're not, this place, we're not accepting it. And he said, you can't negotiate with me. Do you know what I've been through to get you this? And social workers tell me it would be impossible to do this to them. Right? And she said, well, if you go and look at it, and if you think you can live there with your family, come and look me in the eye and tell me, and I'll think about it again. Never heard of that place again. We've got this lovely masonry number 11 pit house on the Wilberforce estate in Battersea. We had to go south of the Thames, which was a trauma for us, but we got over that eventually. Anyway, because I was moving south of the Thames, I used to do a milk round with a guy called Johnny Carter. Carters were a big family around North Kensington. Their dad was a totter, rag and bone man, who always swore that that horse and stepdad son, Hercules, he'd sold it to the BBC, which may well have been true. But Johnny was, my sister went out with Jimmy Carter, and Johnny Carter, his elder brother, was a milkman for Express Dairies and wanted me to help him. And Johnny had been a, you know, bit of a lad, teddy boy, and all that. But now he'd settled into maturity, two kids, married with two kids. And he's a great character. He had this elaborate hairstyle. It was a Tony Curtis with a DA. The D stands for ducks. You can guess what the A stands for. And as he went along on his express dairy float, which didn't go very fast, he'd be looking in the wing mirror. Anyway, because I was moving to Battersea, it was the last time I could help him on his milk round. And Johnny never said, oh, sorry to hear about your mum or anything soft or silly or soppy like that. You know, working class North Kensington, he didn't do that. But at the end of the milk round, he said, come back to my house in St. Anne's Road. Took me down in the basement, opened the doors, and in his basement was this vast array of brand new musical instruments. Which means maybe he was a distributor for a musical instrument. Maybe they'd been nicked. I also did a paraffin round 2 nights a week. You might have to explain paraffin to the younger generation. So Johnny said, just pick, you know, whatever you want. And there was a Vox Solid, dark sunburn Vox Solid electric guitar. That was mine, and it had a gingham case, and I borrowed Linda's lipstick and wrote the vampires across it, and then had to go and form a band called the Vampires, which I did at school with three mates, and you know, I was still playing my way through Burt Wheaton, so I wouldn't say I was proficient, but I was certainly the best musician in the Vampires. And in fact, it was really funny, we were doing an event like this in Monmouth, and I happened to say about the drummer of the Vampires, Jimmy Robb. And I said the joke that John Lennon said. John Lennon was very hard on drummers. When someone said to him, Ringo's one of the best drummers in the world, John Lennon said he's not even the best drummer in the Beatles. But he was even harder on Pete Best, who got elbowed for Ringo. John Lennon said, what's the difference between Pete Best and a chiropodist? Answer, a chiropodist butts up your feet. To think about it. Anyway, I was saying this, and I said about how useless Jimmy Rock was, and this little forlorn voice came from the audience, I'm here, Alan. In time. There are 8 members of the Vampires here. So, you know, that was the first kind of schoolboy band. We were trying to impress girls with our proficiency. Girls used to scream at the Beatles. They used to scream at us, but really just to get us to shut up, because it was so terrible. But then I went on to 2 really good bands, good West London rock group called The Area. And then we had all our gimmicks, and then someone came and sort of headhunted me for a band called The Inbetweens. Had its own fan club, its own manager and all that. And that was brilliant. But once again, they got everything, including another guitar. So the Vox Solid, we got broken into in this flat in Battersea twice. There's another thing about the book, actually, this boy, that there were certain politicians trying to pretend that the 50s and 60s was a golden age, you know.
Yeah.
There was no crime, everything was wonderful. I mean, you know, the only asset for someone to talk about the good old days is a bad memory. I mean, crime was rife. We got broken into twice in what, 2 years? 3 times in 2 years. And they nicked the box. And here comes my mother again, because we've just formed The Area. And I said to my sister, I need a guitar. And there's this wonderful guitar music shop in Wardour Street in Soho. Hofner Verithin, V-E-R-I-T-H-I-N, Hofner Verithin, German company. Stopped making it in 63. And it was beautiful, red, mother of pearl inlay, twin Venetian swirls, Bigsby amp, tremolo, beautiful. I said, but it's 35 quid. And unbeknown to me, my mother somehow had scrubbed, in all the terrible, hard poverty, she had to clean and scrub for all these houses, do all these jobs, which she should have been doing with a serious heart complaint. She'd squirreled away £40 in the post office savings account that my sister was going to give to me when I was 18. And she said, look, I'm 16 now,
yeah,
but the band was up and running. She said, if you want to have that £40 now, rather than when you're 18, to buy the guitar, you can. In a way, it was my mother reaching from beyond the grave to get me that Hofner Verithin guitar. And then I was away, and
yeah,
had a fabulous time. I mean, but by the time the second guitar was, the Hofner Verithin got nicked,
yeah,
when I was with The Inbetweens, I was just about to get married to a single mother. And whereas the bass guitarist, a West Indian guy called Shan, wanted me to form another band with him, The Inbetweens were multiracial, very unusual for 1967. I said, well, I've got to earn some money. He was a postman. He said, why don't you come into the post office? They can't recruit staff because the wages are so bad, but that means you can go loads of overtime, double time, weekends and all that. And so I thought I'd put my music on hold, my musical career, and join the post office.
So, but you were in 3 bands, and you also auditioned for somebody else, for another
Peter
band.
J and the Jaywalkers, yeah. You might remember Peter J and the Jaywalkers. So this terrible absence of pop music on the BBC is what led to the pirate radio stations and 17 million listeners, and they were a generation that the BBC had just missed out, you know, and it eventually led to Radio 1 and all of that complete transformation. But when the BBC still was under this deal where they could only play 16 hours, they would have the big bands like Joe Loss, these old boys in their mid-30s, you know, playing pop records of the time. So, you know, Ted Heath Band plays My Generation. It's awful. On these Sunday lunchtime programmes. But there was a band called Peter J and the Jaywalkers that were, you know, quite authentic. And they used to do they used to be on the BBC lunchtime programmes. I mean, the highest hit they ever had was 31 in the charts. But they auditioned for a rhythm guitarist, backing vocalist. When I was 16, I went along thinking I was Peter Frampton, the face of 66 with the Herd, and I got through to the final kind of knockout. I thought I'd got it, but I didn't get it, unfortunately.
But they disbanded shortly afterwards, didn't
they? They disbanded shortly afterwards because Radio 1 came on.
Oh, right, yeah.
And so they didn't have anything to do anymore,
yeah,
and that was the end of Peter J and the Jaywalkers. So, yeah, it's probably a good Good thing that I didn't get it past the audition.
So as you were putting this book together, you were able to look at the soundtrack of your life in a way, but all the social changes, not just the changes for you personally, but all the things that were happening nationally as well, not only in how we were listening to music, but also things that were affecting society. Can you tell us a little bit more about how that came together for you as you were putting this book together?
Well, I'd already sort of mentioned most of that. This is, you know, if you've read the trilogy of memoirs, don't worry, you know, you can read this. Actually, I don't have to sell it because you have to buy it because they did, didn't you? But this isn't rehashing all of that. It's sort of telling the story, I suppose, in a different way,
yeah.
but through music. So, you know, all the social changes that were going on, the incredible changes that came through the 60s and 70s were as stark in music as well. You know, the change away from fanning towards feast. Suddenly, I mean, the day when Radio 1 started broadcasting, I don't know about anyone else here, I was there September, whatever it was, 1967, when The Move sang Flowers in the Rain and Tony Blackburn at 7 o'clock on a Saturday morning. It was a new era. I mean, that, to me, that was hugely important in my life.
Yeah.
Music was important. And the fact that we've gone, you know, Maggie Miller never entered the Billboard 100 in America, and neither did Pinky or Perky. And, you know, the best we could do over here, with all due respect to Cliff and Billy Fury and those, they were Elvis Presley impersonations. You know, they sang in an American drawl. Cliff came from Chesson in Hearts, but, you know, talked American. Suddenly, when the Beatles came along, this wave of musicality from Mersey. I mean, it's exciting now, looking back. You know, if you see the film 8 days a week, just marvellous to relive it. But to live it in real time, as we did in those days, was just huge. And then, you know, there was no patriotism to it. Having never entered the Billboard 100, the Beatles were number one, number two, number three, and number four. You know, the sensation had conquered the world, changed the world. And in that 5 years version, it was 7 years in total, but they went from very kind of basic Thank You Girl and She Loves You to Tomorrow Never Knows and Strawberry Fields Forever and very complex music. And for us, living it through in real time, you know, we were very proud of that. And there was a generation gap. I mean, this is the thing, there were no elderly rockers in those days. Yeah, because rock was new. We were growing up with it. So as a result, there was a big generation gap. And when Roger Daltrey sang I Hope I Die Before I Get Old, you know, and you know, Bob Dylan, the times they were changing. Mothers and fathers throughout the land. Your sons and your daughters are beyond your command. That was thrilling, mutinous to us listening to it. You know, when you were 21, you were supposed to go away and listen to Vera Lynn. No one listened to pop music who were over the age of 20, kind of thing. And now, of course, I'm an aging rocker. You know, you've got Mick Jagger leaping around at 76. And so trying to describe that, it was a huge change in society reflected through music.
But your music taste has moved on. I mean, in the conclusion of the book, you're saying that you do appreciate modern music, and that you're still enjoying music that's being produced today.
Yeah, and, right the way through. I mean, it ends in '82 when I decided. So I was a great songwriter. I'll give you a little taste of my journey. The song I wrote for my son, but just to give you a bit, you're a good audience, so you deserve this. Although I don't think you paid enough for me to tell you the story. But when I was 19, I wrote a song called Bad Skin about a lad with acne. I've got acne, I've got eczema, I've got every skin disease, gives me pimples I can pick, gives me blackheads I can squeeze. I know it's good, I know. But the real genius was the middle eight. How can any girl want to be with you when every kiss she gets just tastes of Nivea? Well, that's my case. So although I knew I wasn't going to get back in a rock band, because by then I got something involved with the trade union movement and all of that, still thought I'd make it as a songwriter. And from the time he recorded his first album, I loved Elvis Costello. Just loved it, still do. And in 1982, I sat down and we'd got a sound system for the first time. So the old Black & Decker record player that I'd inherited when I married my first wife. English Electric record player. That had gone to this new sound system, which had the audio cassette, the compact audio cassette. And I sat down and recorded 20 of my songs on this tape, just sitting in the front room in the council estate with my guitar, and posted it off to Elvis Costello. And I'm still waiting for it. So that's where the book ends, in 82. But yeah, I mean, you know, I'm not sitting, you know, playing Dire Straits' greatest hits. When people say to me, what's the best phase in music? I say now, because you've got all that terrific back catalogue and you've got all the artists that have been inspired by it. You know, John Grant, the Arctic Monkeys, St. Vincent, you know, great stuff around now. And you've got all the back catalogue as well.
So why did you decide to end the book when you did? How did you decide that you were going to
because
that period?
Because 25 years was about, you know, seemed about right. And from my earliest recollection to the time when I knew I was never going to, because Elvis hadn't replied, maybe I'll still get that. Maybe
yes.
Because they privatised Royal Mail, maybe that's why. But that's when, you know, 82, I went off, I was on the executive of the union. Then I was a national officer, then I was general secretary, then I was an MP. And, you know, I never picked up the guitar for 13 years when I was a government minister. You just, never had the time. So that was about the right time.
And something that's quite interesting in the book I found as well was the social side of music and also the isolation side, the way you could retreat into music sometimes. And certainly when you had a young family, there was a way where you had to plug in the earphones so that you were listening to music in isolation.
Yeah, that was great when, you know, proper headphones came along. You could, so, you know, we were in a council house. There was actually two bedrooms, but we knocked it into three. My wife had three kids. The walls were, we were at the end of a terrace, but the walls weren't that thick. And next door was Mike and Ruth, who had two small children as well. And so you never liked to play music as loud as you wanted to play it. And in any case, we had one through lounge, which was sitting room, dining room. So the kids didn't want to be in their bedrooms when it was cold. They wanted to be down. And so, you know, there was this thing about, how do you access the music you want to listen to when they want to watch, you know, what's on the Blake 7 or whatever on the telly? And it's amazing how a set of headphones, good headphones, not exactly Bose, but good headphones, you suddenly, you know, you've got like getting an extra room.
Yeah.
You can put your records on and you can turn it up as loud as you like and you can listen to it.
Yeah.
And that was like getting an extension to the house.
So you didn't become... Yet, you haven't become yet a rock star, but you have become a successful writer. And part of that has been your journaling. You've been able to draw on the memories to a certain extent, but also the recollections that you wrote at the time. How important is that? Is that journaling? Because I think it's been quite a long time that you've been writing a diary.
I kept a diary from described, I think, in Please, Mr. Postman. My wife. First wife got me a diary for a Christmas present in 1975. And I was really struck by this Victorian idea that a day unrecorded is a day not lived. And of course, you didn't have cameras or anything around. I mean, I've got no photos of the area or the in-betweens because people didn't take many photos. So you didn't have memories that way. But to recall each day, so my wife's Boots Page A Day diary, Christmas present in 1975, became a real habit. And every year since then, I've got, you know, a Page A Day diary, which kind of didn't help me at all with the first memoir, because it finished when I was 18, was a bit more helpful with the second one, and was very helpful for The Long and Winding Road. And it also was a way that you wrote every day. It was like, you know, I couldn't go to bed without cleaning the teeth, I couldn't go to bed without doing my Page A Day diary. I'm not so good at it now. But it kept me writing as well. I always wanted to be a writer. When I was 14, 15, I wanted to be a writer. And I had a great English teacher who inspired and encouraged me, Mr. Carlin, who got me to send my stupid stories off to magazines and publications. And, you know, when I got the inevitable rejection slips, Mr. Carlin would say, "Ah, all the great authors have had rejection slips." They could paper their walls with rejection. He was a great man, Mr. Carlin. And he got us all reading. He was also my political awakening, because he got us all reading Animal Farm, like a, it was a boys' school, 30 boys in the class, passing round Animal Farm and reading the next bit. And we were all engrossed. Mr. Carlin had a natural authority. These were the days of cane, of course. I got caned a lot. Got caned, my hair was too long, got caned because I wore red socks, got caned because I was late for school. Mr. Carlin never had to use or even threaten corporal punishment. And so we all read Animal Farm. He would explain the subtext of the Bolshevik Revolution. And I've never forgotten that. It gave me a love for George Orwell from this parish, right? River Orwell, to speak to his name. Lived in Southwold. And he took us kids to the theatre for the first time. You know, see Oblomov by Spike Milligan. And saw that I was a voracious reader. And asked me if he ever read Dickens, and got me reading Dickens. Arnold Bennett was a C.S. Forrester, Jeffrey Household, you know, Rogue Man, all of those. And he was such an inspiration. And when this boy was published, I tracked him down. He's still alive. And I invited him to the launch of this boy. And he doesn't remember a single bloody thing about me. I was one of thousands of readers. But that ambition to write, I kind of put it on hold for 50 years, and now I just love everything about writing. I love the isolation. I love the control. You're never in control in the trade union movement, and you're never in control in politics.
Yeah.
You know, when I was general secretary, you know, my members had a conference once a year, and I had to go off and try and do what I was mandated to do, and events happened, and people walked out, there was a strike, suddenly you were never in control. And you're never in control on politics, as you probably noticed at the moment. Whereas here, you're totally in control, and even more now because I'm writing fiction.
Yes.
You know, memoirs, of course, you have to stick to the story sort of thing. Whereas with fiction, you can take your characters, you can play God. You can take your characters anywhere you want to take them. I just love all of that.
And you've explored that in two ways. I mean, a couple of years ago we met and you were talking about historical fiction, and you've now gone on to something different. So are you able to tell us a little bit about what you're planning to do?
Yeah, it's a thriller with kind of comedic elements and romantic elements. So I did something in a newspaper, I think Sunday Times a couple of weeks ago, where they asked me what this book would be, and I said, I want it to be a book that you'd want question whether your wife or your servant should read it. Now, and this guy didn't know what I was talking about, and you obviously don't either. The Trial of Lady Chatterley's Lover, one of the essential issues of the 1960s, the judge said to the jury, you have to decide, is this a book that you'd want your wives or your servants to read? Shows you how the 60s changed everything. What I meant is there'd be sex, it'd be racy. I didn't, you know, I'm a bit worried about my mother-in-law reading it. So, you know, I want it to be a blockbuster, sell the film rights, retire to Hawaii, all of that. And then I get back to the historical fiction.
Right, okay. Well, we'll leave it at that. does anybody have any questions of their own that they'd like to ask about? No. Yes, over there. Can you shout? Sorry, we haven't got a microphone, so if you could just shout and we'll repeat the question.
I want to still play guitar, keep yourself amused with another.
Yeah, but we, in the end, play. Yes, I'm good at chords. I was good at rhythm guitarist. Backing vocalist. In fact, when I was with the In-Betweeners, they had a wonderful singer. So Motivation, as I said, the singer was a lovely girl called Carmen, who was half Indian and half German. And she was a lead singer. but on two songs I took front of stage. One was All or Nothing by the Small Faces, and the other one was Wild Thing by the Trogs. And you really haven't had a cultural experience unless you saw the in-betweens before the Wild Thing. Carmen would dance around me while I sang, there's that bit in the Wild Thing. I think I love you. Ding, 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 ding. She would drape her arm across the room. Just have a minute to think about that. I was mad at her. She married a bloody drummer. No one married her. And they did happily ever after. But no, I don't play so much now. So 2010, I not only decided to write a book when we lost the election, I went straight out and bought myself a Yamaha acoustic six string because I had a 12 string echo, and retuning it every time was fine. So I never played, as I say, for 13 years. So when I got myself a Yamaha, and I tell the story in the book, I got the Hofner Very Thin back again.
Yes.
So it was nicked in 1967 with all the in-betweens gear. I actually mentioned on radio that I had this Hofner Very Thin that I loved. And this guy rang me from Edinburgh and said, I've got a Hofner Very Thin of that exact vintage with the Bixby tremolo, with the two Venetian swirls, with the mother of pearl inlay. I'll bring it down and show it to you. It came to Hull, to where I live, to my constituency, as it was at the time. And we met in the Holiday Inn on the marina. And as he opened the case, I just knew that was my bloody guitar. That was, yeah, and I couldn't prove it. It's got a serial number inside, but I've never kept the serial number of the original. Anyway, I knew we were reunited. And this guy, I mean, I knew he wasn't involved in the crime. He had a reasonable alibi of not having been born at the time. I charged him £800. It cost him £35, and I bought it, charged me £800. So I'm reunited with my partner, very good. So I pick it up occasionally, fiddle about.
Isn't your son a musician now?
Yes, he is. I live my life vicariously for him. So yeah. My oldest son. So I've got another son that was born in 2010. But Jamie, yeah, he's... the other week, I do this week thing with Michael Portillo and Andrew Neil. And we had the former lead singer I've forgotten the name of the band now. Did America. Gone right out of my mind.
We'll come back to it.
Yeah, okay. Anyway, he worked with Paul Weller on four of his albums. He's worked with various artists. Supertramp, that's it. Not Supertramp, no. I'll come back to it. Sorry, Jamie. David Gilmour, he's worked with these incredible. Alice Costello, he's worked with. So I've lived my life vicariously through him.
Okay. Any other questions?
As you mentioned, your son, Joel,
yes. Did your son mention it? Elvis Costello. Did your son mention it?
Yeah, did I know? No, I don't think he did. No, he was actually Elvis Costello on a video, a film that was made about him in America, actually mentions my son as one of the most talented recording engineers he's ever worked with. But, I thought Jamie could have at least put a word in. I don't think Jamie appreciated bad singers such as I did.
Razor light,
well done. Supertramp, yeah. Johnny Burrell, that was the one. So when I was on This Week with him, Johnny Burrell just kept going on to me about Jamie. Didn't want to know anything about what I did. Where's Jamie now? Is he getting on?
Anybody else? Yes.
You seem to have a good time with Michael Portillo on This Week. Do you offstage get sort of heated discussions because you're at two ends of the political spectrum?
No, I think the success of This Week, which has been going on for 15 years, and gets at times, it always gets more than a million, but 1.6 million sometimes. Newsnight is lucky to get 300,000. Extraordinary viewing figures for something that comes on at 11:45, and that's just the people who watch it then, not the ones who watch it the next day. But I think its success is because it doesn't take itself too seriously, and you could discuss issues without it being the normal kind of bull at the gate stuff. I mean, Michael's interesting because I was going to say he's been on a journey, but he's never on a solid train. It's really, really nice. You know, the Michael Portillo who was the defence secretary wrapping himself in the flag, a very different Michael Portillo. He's probably the happiest man I know, the most satisfied man. And he says his big mistake wasn't in stepping down from Parliament, as he did eventually in 2015. It was going back. You remember he was beaten by Stephen Twigg. All us Labour supporters kept watching that video in 97 when Stephen Twigg beat Michael Portillo in Enfield and Southgate. Michael reckons his mistake is coming back as the MP for Kensington and Chelsea. And he's now very happy doing what he's doing. And he's now on Europe, I'm afraid. He's no different on Europe than he always was, although he was always against the referendum. He was absolutely scathing about Cameron's decision to have a referendum, even though he was a Leaver. He thought it was the wrong way to decide it. It was the worst thing to do, the worst time to do it. But now that we're into it, he's reverted to type. But no, we can discuss our differences. I mean, I don't know whether you noticed this, but Andrew's hardly on the far left. So, you know, they're both in a way pro-Europe. But Andrew Neil, I think, is the most forensic interviewer on the television. And it doesn't matter who he's up against or what his own political opinions were. He's actually a council house guy from the state in Paisley, council estate in Paisley. But he gives them a hard time. You know, he does his homework. And I'm a huge admirer of his interviewing skills.
Yep, in the middle.
When you first joined the Labour Party in 71, did you ever think to yourself, I'm going to be sitting on the front bench of Parliament next to the likes of Blair, Brown and so on?
No, of course I didn't, no. I joined, I think it was in 73 actually, but when I joined, it's actually a New Statesman piece I wrote that's coming out this week on the night that changed my life. It was me and my mate sitting at the bar of the Slough Supporters Club deciding, instead of moaning about things, we ought to get out and do something. And we joined the Labour Party together. You know, this is why I say I've been incredibly lucky. My route was the trade union, and the trade union movement gave me all these educational opportunities as well. And so, you know, these things happen almost by accident, that you become the branch chair of the Slough Amalgamated Branch of the Union of Post Office Workers. And then the next thing you think, oh, I'd like to be on the executive. And you get on the executive, and then the executive, you think, I'd like to be national officer. And the national officer, you think, I'd like to be general secretary. And that's all the story I'm told in the long and winding road. I really wanted to be general secretary of the union. Once I became general secretary, as again, I tell the story, you know, whereas colleagues who tried to get into Parliament have moved their family to places where they think the MP is going to pop his clogs, you know, just waiting to get and go through this horrendous process. Whereas I was kind of asked, will you be an MP? When my predecessor in Hull, Weston Hessel, left to spend more time with his peerage, I kind of got parachuted in from being general secretary of the union to being an MP. And we, you know, we swept to power in 97, and we were in power till 2010. And, you know, just the opportunities then, being a minister, and you suddenly see, you know, you've done all that. So no, I didn't expect to do that at all. And I regard myself as being very, very lucky. You know, you take a parallel. A guy called Austin Mitchell, who got elected in Great Grimsby when Anthony Crossland died, 1977. He was a big television star up in East Yorkshire. And so he used to kind of look north and all that, I think. No, he did the ITV equivalent, Callaghan. And Austin must have thought, I've got this brilliant career ahead of me in politics, you know, Labour benches. And then Thatcher got here, and then it was 18 years. And by then, Austin was kind of yesterday's man. So, you know, I was really lucky to hit that tide, and it did.
But are there opportunities for people to get into politics in the same way, do you think? I mean, is it just attracting the same?
I think there is. There's a postman sitting on the Tory benches who they selected in a seat in Cornwall. And I heard he was a postman. I went to a guy called Scott Mann, got in 2010. And when someone said to me he was a postman, I thought, yeah, people say that, I was a postman. And lots of you might say, I was a postman. No, you weren't. You were a bloody Christmas casual, right? Doesn't count. It turned out Scott was a postman. And I think what political parties, and this is a good news story, I suppose, is they all got so concerned when the three party leaders, Clegg, Miliband, Cameron, had all come from that same route, PPE at Oxford or Cambridge, you've a job as an intern perhaps, and then you came up as a seat was found for you, and then so you got to be, you know, Prime Minister or Deputy Prime Minister in Cameron and Clegg's case without any discernible career in between, just politics. And I think all parties would get a bit worried about that. But that's the only way it would change, because political parties select their candidates. And if they're just looking for people from a particular, with a particular, off the treadmill, then it will never change. But I think it is changing.
Good. Yes, a couple more.
No, I didn't have any ambition. The question was, did I ever have ambition to be Prime Minister? No, is the answer to that. And I don't think, I said, I was having a sort of chat with Kirsty Young on the radio, and I thought it was me and her, but it was 7 million listeners on things like this. She asked me a straight question, I gave her a straight answer. I didn't want to do it. I mean, I think there's no one who leaves 10 Downing Street more wise, sagacious, or sane and rational than when they walked in, you know? I think it's a tough job. Thank God there are people who want to do it. I never wanted to do it. I wanted to be General Secretary of the Union. I never wanted to be Prime Minister. And I'm sorry about that. I do apologise, but, you know, you do. I think if you don't want to do it, you're not going to do it all that well anyway. You have to want to do a job like that.
Over in the corner there.
If I can take you back to the early years, hopefully your childhood. You didn't mention Brian Matthews, who appeared or didn't appear, was on the Light programme every Saturday morning on Saturday.
Saturday, yeah.
Presumably, the reason he was able to run that programme was because most of the bands there were playing live.
Yes.
Yes,
exactly.
So many records
to be played. I'm glad you mentioned that. I should have given a mention in the book. I don't think I mentioned Brian Matthews. He's only died quite recently and was still doing that Saturday morning.
Yeah, he died, didn't he?
Yeah, quite recently. Yeah, but Saturday Club, late 50s, early 60s, was, you know, we all tuned into that. But yeah, because they played live, there's actually a Beatles album of the recordings they did for the BBC. Mostly on Saturday Club.
Thanks. Couple more? Yes, in the middle.
On a Thursday night, when we sit down and watch the telly with a glass of wine, we have a discussion. What colour shirt is Michael Cotillo going to be wearing tonight?
Oh, it'll be lurid, it'll be unfashionable, it'll be so rubbish. I have to sit and look at it nearby, you know, you have to see it filtered through your television screens. Yeah, we're doing a Christmas one this week, so we're on this Thursday, so we'll have to dress up
and
stupid stuff.
Has Andrew got the same tie on as he wore last week and the week before, and we can do the striking?
You are very observant. I'll mention that to you, yeah? Yeah, don't worry. Concern viewer. Every time.
I've got time, just a couple more, yes. Gentleman over.
You sort of imply that there was nothing between the Beatles and Nellie the Elephant, apart from people like Cliff Richard. But what's your view of the stuff that Joe Meek did and the musicians that came out of that particular state?
Yeah, you're right. If you read the book, you'll see that you're right, it sounded like there was nothing in between. There was Shaken All Over by Johnny Kidd and the Pirates for a start in 1960, which was an amazing. I mean, I thought it was American when I first heard it. It was British pop music. And Joe Meek and all those, Telstar and all that stuff. But it was pretty simple stuff, you know. It was important in its way, but still most of the people we listened to in the late 50s, early 60s were American. It was the Everly Brothers, or it's Bobby V, or it's Johnny Burnett, or Johnny Tillotson, or, you know, all of those. And on this side, we were just trying to emulate what they were doing on the other side of the Atlantic, whereas when the Beatles came along, it was something. They wrote their own songs for a start, you know, which was unheard of. And even then, I'm still in that generation gap. I can still go back and think of it. You know, the older generation, first of all, you know, said the Beatles looked terrible and their hair was too long. And then when they suddenly liked some of their songs yesterday, there used to be these arguments. I remember sitting on a number 11 bus going to school, listening to the bus conductor talking to some old sod who was about 42. And they were both saying, the Beatles had been on Sunday night in London Palladium or something, they were both saying, well, of course, those kids couldn't have written those songs. You know, Tin Pan Alley would have provided them. They couldn't have written those songs like that. And I was sort of burning. I was being, you know, my heroes were being defamed. So, you know, that debate went on and on, but the Beatles did write their own songs, unlike the Stones, who took a bit of time to start writing their songs, although I do like the Stones. The Stones are fine.
It is quite interesting seeing the reviews for this book, because a number of the reviewers sort of, they either like or dislike it according to the taste of music as well. If they disagree with some of the points that you've made about certain...
Yeah, I liked it.
No, no, they liked the book, but yeah. I mean, they had issues about the taste of music.
Exactly. Music is, you know, subjective, isn't it? And that's great to have those arguments. I mean, I did this thing at the Cambridge Literary Festival with David Hepworth, who wrote this book about 1971. He said it was the best year for pop music. And, you know, it was a pretty provocative thing to say. His book sold very well. But at the Cambridge Literary Festival, we were talking it over, and someone in the audience, you know, I'd pointed out actually that 1971, you know, was when Ernie the fastest milkman in the West, and then someone from the audience started berating David, and David said, "Well, if you think another year is better, write your own bloody book." Because in the end, in music, you know, what you like, and of course. And I had this, I think it was at the Marlborough Literary Festival, this woman said to me, "You don't say much about the Stones." And I said, "Well, in the book I do say a lot, because it wasn't true that people liked either the Stones or the Beatles. Most people liked both the Beatles and the Stones." But I said, if you want to have an argument for who had the most profound impact on the progression of pop music, you know, the Stones' first record was a Beatles Lennon McCartney composition, "I Want to Be Your Man." Not just a Lennon McCartney composition, the one they chucked away to Ringo on with the Beatles. Anyway, this woman came out, she bought a book and came and talked to me. She was the manager of the Rolling Stones. She got me to do a book to Ronnie Wood saying, "I'm sorry, but I still prefer the Beatles." So you never know who's going to be in the audience.
Right, well, this is the fourth of your memoirs. They've all got Beatles titles, as Beatles songs as your titles. In my life, if you'd like to get another copy tonight, there are plenty of copies over here. I'm sure you'll enjoy reading your own copy. It's a fantastic book, really brilliant read, as are all your books. And we very much look forward to the fiction that comes next. But thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Catherine. Thank you very much.